And the topic of the talk was the body-mind connection. So anyway, this is the time for the Dhamma talk. And so first of all, we should understand, well, what is the Dhamma? Now, for Buddhists, the Dhamma, when you say the Dhamma, it usually refers to the teachings of the Buddha. But then you might ask, well, then what did the Buddha teach? He taught the Dhamma. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg, the Buddha or the Dhamma? Of course, as we understand from the teachings, the Buddha himself merely said, I've rediscovered the ancient path, the ancient truths that had been lost for a long period of time, and had rediscovered those truths about the existence and, offering that to the people in his teaching. But in a broader sense, you know, what the Buddha taught basically was in the Dhamma, one meaning is the laws of nature. So the Buddha really taught about the laws of nature, but specifically in terms of how they work in our bodies and mind, in the nature of our bodies and mind, and the interaction of our bodies and mind in the world around us, especially in terms of what causes conflict and suffering, and what promotes well-being and happiness. And, you know, all beings are searching for happiness. And that's the drive of every living being, is to try to, find happiness and to avoid pain. And even when you come down to a tiny ant crawling on the ground, if you put your finger down in front of an ant, what happens? It'll stop, or it'll turn around, or go around, or go back, because it senses some danger there. So when something as tiny as a little ant, there's something very alive there. There's something very aware. And even an ant, his drive to live is to, you know, live in happiness and to avoid pain. That's why he felt some threat from your finger. But anyway, so even though people are trying to find happiness in the world, very often they do the things that bring them unhappiness and downright pain and suffering by not understanding the elemental laws of nature. Now, one of the fundamental laws of nature is what we normally call the law of karma, but it's very similar to the law of gravity. So with the law of gravity, if you throw something up, what happens? It comes down, right? Sometimes with a big thud. So if we throw something out of our mouth, it goes out in the world and mingles with the bodies and minds of other beings and comes back to us in Newton's law as an equal or opposite reaction. So both the law of gravity and Newton's law are very intimately some foundational aspects of the nature of the body and the mind, and connected with that law of karma. Now the Buddha, the whole teaching of the Dhamma can be summed up in the two verses of the Dhammapada, which go: all actions are led by the mind. Mind is their master. Mind is their maker. If one acts or speaks with an impure mind, then suffering follows, as the cart wheel follows the foot of the ox. And in the same way, if one acts or speaks with a pure state of mind, then happiness follows, as your shadow follows you around. So, you know, all the other teachings of the Buddha, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and are all pointing at that, centered around that. The whole training of the Dhamma is about how to understand and to hopefully live in harmony with the laws of nature. But most people are living out of harmony with the laws of nature. That means their actions of body, speech, and mind are driven by selfish attachment or greed or anger and hatred and ill will and just egotism. And not understanding the nature of the mind, people get all ensnared and entangled in that love of kama, and their actions and thoughts and speech, you know, come back to, you know, cause them problems. So understanding the mind is really one of the most important aspects of the practice of the Dhamma. But the mind is not easily gotten a hold of. I mean, people are trying to control their minds by so many different things that they're doing, or even control their bodies. And usually it's by some kind of external means that they're trying to, overcome certain habits, unhealthy habits and so on. But a lot of those things are not entirely successful. So the understanding the mind and the body and the mind-body connection is the beginning step of understanding what our life is. And actually, to go back even further, our bodies and mind were actually born together. You know, at the moment of conception, when the mother and father produce the material elements to form a new being, consciousness comes into that being, into that material organism at the same time, and that's what activates it, basically. And in 9 months in the womb, you go from a one-cell organism to a multi-billion cell organism in the space of 9 months. I mean, that's a lot of energy going on there. And that consciousness that came together at that first moment, each cell division, that consciousness also goes into each succeeding cell. So you can say that every cell of the body has a type of awareness. And, you know, even one-cell amoebas have a type of awareness. You know, they move around, and every living being, from the smallest of insects, they have a rudimentary type of awareness. So anyway, every cell in the body, and they're connected in what I call the inner internet. You know, we have the external internet, but the body has its own internet. And every cell in the body, they communicate to each other. The cell in your toe communicates with the cells in your brain, which communicate with every other cell to trigger off all the various interrelated systems. We all know that. So basically, for 9 months, the body and mind were together, you know, basically the same, infused together. They weren't separate. And also, this wonderful human body, which, most people regard as the most highest point of evolution that we know of. and this body was created without the IBM computers, without Steven Jobs, without the doctors or anything else, because that came from natural wisdom. So the nature has its own wisdom, and it comes from that fundamental understanding of awareness that is throughout all the cells. And basically, that was also in the present moment. All that was occurring in the present moment. And when the baby is born, the baby's consciousness is still in the present moment. But what happens when the baby's born? One of the first things that happens. The doctor gets the, then cuts the cord. Now the baby becomes separate. It gets disconnected from that life force. And then parents give it a name. And then all the relatives come over and hold it and start giving it things. And, you know, all of you mothers here, you know, very well know that, you know, for the 6 months of a baby's life, you know, it's basically mostly in the present moment. You know, it hasn't formulated words and associations yet, but gradually it does. And little by little, that centeredness in the present moment, that centeredness in the body gets drawn out. And even child developmental psychologists, you know, will tell you that those first 6 months, or especially the first few months of the baby's mind is, you know, in a state of more or less oceanic awareness, very expanded awareness. It wasn't centered behind the eyeballs so much. But little by little, as it gets language and people start giving it things, its consciousness starts to go out and it gets separated from the body and it starts to focus in the external world. And it gradually loses that connection, that natural connection to the present moment and to the body. Because the body basically is a connection to the present moment. For most all practical and all intents and purposes, because the mind resides within this body. This body is the vehicle for the mind. But as the attention goes outward, we lose that connection to the body, and most people never regain it. And that's the fundamental cause of suffering, is this disconnection from the body. But essentially, that means the present moment. Because the body is always in the present moment. It's always just here. And the sensations in the body. But the mind is what is going between the past and the future. And the past and the future also are within the mind. And all problems are problems of the past and future. Try to think of any problem that you have and see if it isn't connected in one way or another with the past or future. Good, I'll give you 5 seconds. Quick, think. Anybody think of anything? So, most problems, are of fear and worry and judgments and comparisons are about, you know, the objects outside. Because we've lost that connection to the body. And then when a sweet grandmother comes and gives the baby its first chocolate, and then it tastes the chocolate, it gets a pleasant feeling. And then it starts identifying the face of the grandmother with pleasurable feeling. And it starts to hope that face will come again in the future because it's expecting a pleasurable feeling. And if the uncle or grandfather comes by and holds the baby, squeezes it too tight, or doesn't give it anything, then it either forms a neutral feeling or a painful feeling toward that face. And that is the birth of the past and future in the mind. That's where the past and future is born. At that moment, when we start identifying pleasurable feeling to certain objects and painful feeling to other objects, and basically that continues our whole life in connection with what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and even the thoughts. Everything that we've ever experienced in life, the mind has categorized them as this is something pleasurable, that's going to bring me happiness, or something that's painful that's going to bring me unhappiness. And the mind is in a constant tug of war between seeking pleasurable objects and to avoiding the painful objects. And that's because that's all it knows. It's lost that connection to the body. And so it's unable to stay connected to the body, to that vibration of the present moment where there isn't this past and future thinking. Because that's what also breeds greed and hatred, is all based on pleasurable feelings and painful feelings. And all of our karmic actions, almost everything we do in our life, is based on this trying to get or capture or hold on to pleasurable feeling and to get away from and struggle against or scheme and plan how are you going to prevent the painful feelings from coming again in the future. And that's what is the source of most people's worry, anxiety, fear, and virtually every other type of problem. And all of the ills of the world, or conflicts in the world, whether it's inside of ourselves or it's in others or in the world in general, society and so on, is based on that same thing. And that's simply because people have lost that fountain or source of happiness, which is being grounded in the present moment. And so again, this is a kind of a foundation of that body-mind connection. But specifically, when we try to meditate, and of course the first stage of meditation is learning how to bring the mind back into the body to become centered and grounded in the body, but really because that's the source of the present moment. For most people, that's the easiest way to get reconnected to the present moment. So you use the breathing, you practice breathing awareness. So the breathing is occurring in the present moment. You feel your body, posture, you feel the sensations. All those things are just present moment sensations. And it's the only thing that's reliable because they're always there with us. And that's why the Buddha, chose the mindfulness of the body as the first stage of practicing mindfulness meditation. And also, we've lost that natural intelligence. As I mentioned, the baby was born through natural wisdom. But we've been disconnected from that. And so, the body normally knows how to heal itself, with all of its different, immune system and other types of interrelated systems. But now when the average person injures themselves, they have to go to the doctor. The doc, what's the matter with me? Give me something to cure this problem. Or even a more basic than that, because we're not grounded in the body, we make a lot of mistakes. And so we, and through our being focused in the external world, we've interfered with these natural systems of the body. Like if you cut yourself, you should be able to, the blood cells clot and stop the bleeding, or if you get some other bacteria, the immune system should, gobble up those foreign bacteria. But because we've interfered, a lot of these natural functions are not working very well in a lot of people. And the various diseases that people have acquired. And so on the one point, we've interfered with through our unhealthy types of living and because of our, attachments and being focused in the external world. We're not listening to the early warning signals of the body. So we pick up a lot of bad habits because people have been disconnected from the body. So when a young person starts to smoke, for example, when they're a teenager. I talk from my own experience. That, you know, after some time, you know, you're smoking and then the body starts. So it's trying to tell you something, right? So when you go to light up a cigarette, the body is kind of silently trying to tell you, don't do that, don't do that. But the mind says, shut up. So, you know, our mind can be the biggest enemy to our body. And then not only that, then there's so many other habits, like eating, you know, unhealthy foods and all kind of habits that we have that are causing our body problems. You know, we're not really listening to it. And we don't know how to really heal that. So anyway, I'm just kind of just outlining all this to kind of illustrate how learning how to, you know, get reconnected to the body in the present moment, to regain, help to regain that natural sensitivity and to regain that connection to natural wisdom, that is all part of the meditation practice. And actually, the word meditation comes from the same word as medicine. And also mediation. So that root word, M-E-D-I, it kind of means being in the middle. So, you know, a mediator sits in the middle between two opposing, disputing parties. Medicine is in the middle between sickness and health. And meditation is in the middle between past and future. So that means real meditation is bringing the mind back to the present moment, to help to regain that natural awareness and natural wisdom that comes with it. And that's really what meditation is, ultimately. And so all the different techniques that you might, that are out there as meditation, you know, they're all designed in somehow or another, helping to bring the mind gradually, bringing it back to the center. And even yoga. The word yoga also means bringing two things back together to make one, which is essentially means bringing the mind and body back together too, yoking together. And so that's why, actually, I was going to explain in my own experience when I started meditating back in 1973, In Nepal, I went to a meditation course. At that time, I didn't know anything about yoga or meditation. And we had to sit many hours a day. And there, you know, lots of pain. You know, they had no chairs in those days. Everyone had to sit on the ground somehow and you know, try to get comfortable. And it was a lot of painful. And, you know, the deal with sleepiness and pain. But then during the breaks, you know, there were some people doing some yoga out behind the meditation tent. So I went and observed them, and I, you know, said, well, what are you doing? They said, oh, you were doing some yoga exercise. Well, what's that for? I said, oh, it helps you to meditate better. So I said, oh, really? And so, you know, I started practicing some of that. And after a few days, you know, I felt it was helping me to, you know, to be more, not have so much sleepiness in the meditation, and also to have a little better feeling in the body by, you know, getting a little bit flexible and so on. So when we come to the meditation, you know, the practice of meditation, you know, the body is one of the biggest obstacles for beginners especially, and learning how to sit straight. And meditation actually happens between your brain and the spinal column, because that's where all the nervous system vibrations are coming through our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and going through the nervous system, which is located, you know, along the spine to the brain, where you register consciousness. So keeping the back straight is one of the important aspects of meditation, the posture. And because sleepiness is one of the worst hindrances. There's three main hindrances for meditators. I mean, traditionally they talk about five, but in a more actual fundamental way, the three main ones are sleepiness, physical pain, and too many thoughts. So all thoughts, that means sense, desire, ill will, doubts, and restlessness, and worry, all these things are lumped into, let's say, an umbrella group of thoughts. You know, just too many thoughts. So basically, those three hindrances are the main things that people struggle with in meditation. In fact, meditation would be the natural state of the mind. That means awareness, present moment awareness, should be the natural state of a consciousness. And when you overcome those hindrances, the mind automatically regains its one-centered and one-pointed, its present moment awareness. And so really what most people call meditation is just learning how to overcome those hindrances, especially in the beginning. Of course, there's more to it than that, but overcoming those hindrances is probably, you know, at least 75% of the practice. The rest of it's gravy, or the rest of it goes much, much easier once the mind has overcome drowsiness, has become, you know, centered and awake in the present moment. And in doing that also, you learn how to endure pains as well, and by sitting straight and doing some exercise, then it helps to minimize the pain. Most pain in the body comes from the energy not flowing properly, and it's because people's their joints are stiff, or their muscle tissue is densely compacted. You know, it's not flexible. So the life force, you know, the oxygen you breathe in, as well as the other aspects of life force, can't really penetrate all the nooks and crannies of the body and mind and nervous system because of this, largely because of stiffness and so on. And most pain is due to that blockage of that flow of energy. So that's one of the foundations of like doing the yoga exercise. So when you do yoga exercise, you are primarily, many of the yoga exercises are centered on getting flexibility in the spine, be able to, you know, forward bending, backward bending, side bending, even lateral twisting, so that the nervous system is in its optimal state. And the biggest problem for beginning meditators, even not only beginners, but many people, is, you know, the sleepiness comes from, losing the straight posture, from, you know, slouching. So the first thing that happens, right, we have this big head, right? It weighs 2 or 3 kilos, depending on how much hair you have or how many gold crowns you have. But anyway, we have this big chin sticking out, and there's nothing underneath it to support it. So the first thing that happens is gravity grabs the chin and starts pulling it down. And because we don't have attention to the body, or our neck muscles are weak, you know, that's the first thing that happens, the chin comes down. And when the chin comes down, it causes your shoulders to kind of come in, and the whole spinal column starts slouching. And before you know it, you're totally spaced out, lost in your thoughts, or half asleep. And then different pains. You get pains in your shoulder, pains in the different parts of the body. And so your meditation basically doesn't progress very far. So that's one of the importance of learning how, using part of that body-mind connection is seeing how important it is to be able to sit straight so that the mind can gradually you know, become more centered. And so the sitting straight will prevent you or help to prevent sleepiness, and also to minimize pain, and also eventually then to be able to more clearly see your thoughts too, because you'd be more awake. And the reason why we can't, how many people get lost in their thoughts when they meditate? Why is that? Why do you get lost in your thoughts? Of course, you know, you might give many reasons, but it all comes down to you didn't see them coming. Right? The teacher says, okay, you know, try to focus on your breathing or feel the body. And because we have difficulty doing that, we get lost in our thoughts. We don't see the thoughts coming. Because thoughts arise from the very deep part of the unconscious mind. But usually our attention is either half asleep or it's thinking about the past and future, or worrying, or so many, you know, thoughts. So it's not grounded in the body. So that's why the first stage of meditation, if you want to really control the thoughts, you've got to bring your attention down to the level where thoughts are arising. And then when you can see thoughts, when they're just a little blip on the radar screen, a thought or an urge, when it's still quite weak, then that awareness sort of knocks the wind out of it, and it doesn't rise up. But because most people, if they're slouching, or even if they're meditating and their mind is wandering, thoughts kind of sneak up like this and, you know, envelop their mind before they even know it, what was happening. And then 5 minutes later, oh my God, and then they forgot that they were even in the room. So our thoughts are like an octopus, you know, eight-armed octopus. So if an octopus gets one arm on you, without too much difficulty, you can peel it off and toss it. But each time the octopus gets another tentacle on you, it gets harder and harder to get it off. And once he gets seven or eight on you, he drags you out to the sea and drowns you and eats you. And unfortunately, that's what happens to a lot of people. They get eaten by their thoughts, or they get drowned in their thoughts first, and then if they don't know how to get out of that, eventually they get eaten. And that's a term for, unfortunately, maybe taking one's own life, or so many other nervous breakdowns and so on, because people don't know how to get out of their thoughts. And it's largely because they've lost that connection and they don't know how to get reconnect to the body in the present moment. And also becoming aware of your intentions and all of our actions. You know, all of our actions, various actions, whether you're going to talk, speak something, or act with the body, or even to think, requires an intention. But these intentions come from deep within the nervous system. I mean, deep from the unconscious mind, usually produced by a feeling. So you feel a pleasant and painful feeling, and that triggers off perceptions, triggers off thoughts, and then you get carried away by them. So that's why learning how to get grounded and centered in the body in the present moment is really that first stage of the meditation. And then also deep breathing is also a very beneficial thing for, especially for beginning meditators to develop. Now, normally when you learn Buddhist meditation, they tell you don't control the breath, don't control the breath. Just watch the breath in its uncontrolled nature. Well, now that's all right, and especially it's true when you reach deeper levels of meditation, but for most people, their breath is very shallow, and so they try to feel their breath, and there's hardly anything there. You know, it's not strong enough to catch their attention. And so it easily gets pulled into other things. And so this is actually where in yoga, you know, if you ever studied yoga, the asana and pranayama, or the postures and the deep breathing is a prerequisite for deeper meditation, even for concentration. And so even though the Buddha may not have taught yoga per se as such, he well understood a lot of these things. So anyway, when you start meditation, by doing some deep, slow breathing, and not maybe just one or two, but even developing to be able to do some deep, slow breathing for 5 or 10 minutes, it accomplishes a couple of different things. It accomplishes, for one thing, the deep breathing oxygenates the blood, and then the blood takes that out and sort of charges up all the cells with, you know, life force and awareness. And also, it takes more effort to take a deep breath. And so that effort is going to help you to stay focused. So you learn how to, you know, take a deep, slow breath, fill up the lungs, like take several seconds to breathe in, and even hold in the air for 2 or 3 seconds to allow the oxygen into the lungs to get into the bloodstream, and then slowly breathe out. And also, that to feel the expansion and contraction of the abdomen or the rib cage or the chest, that also helps the mind stay centered in the body. And so by doing that kind of deep, slow breathing, that brings the attention into the center of the body. And then you start to feel the posture itself. Those are the first two stages of the Buddha's instruction, were to, you know, practice the you know, breathing in and breathing out, awareness. Know that you're breathing in, know that you're breathing out, and know that you're sitting. The four postures. And that was, the purpose of that was for bringing the mind in back to the present moment. And also bringing it to a deeper level of awareness. So once you've, that's why actually before you sit to meditate, it's a good idea to actually do a few stretching exercises and some deep breathing, because then when you sit down, you already have you've already spent, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of doing this kind of deep breathing and exercise, so the attention has been, you know, coming more inside the body. And so when you sit to meditate, you're halfway there already. You don't have to struggle so much, beat your head against the wall to try to, focus on the breathing and the posture. So, and then once the awareness gets centered in the body and the breathing, what I call the breathing body, is you really, some people say, well, I just focus on the breathing, or I just focus on the body, really. They operate together. You can't really separate them. I mean, you could if you wanted to, but I don't think that's the way the Buddha really taught the practice. Because in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is the main teaching of the Buddha on insight meditation, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which where the Vipassana meditation comes from, that, you know, it first has you get centered in the breathing and the body, the posture. And then it goes on to feeling the sensations, the four elements, which are basically the various sensations that you feel in the body that are, you know, coming and going. And then that puts you in touch with the thoughts, and to observe your the mental activities. So it's like a stepping stone. The body is a stepping stone to reach the mind, and eventually to reach the consciousness itself. So, and this is what I've seen also in the, you know, since I started, and I've been familiar with Buddhist monasteries and also yoga centers and so on, we know of yoga, you know, developed in this country, but primarily it's focused on the body and not so much to a much and meditation. If you go to the yoga centers, they may do a little bit of, you know, 5 minutes or so of some kind of meditation, but primarily it's focused on the body. And if you go to many Buddhist centers, they say, oh, don't pay too much attention to the body. Just, it's all the mind, you know. And so, and also from what they might have read in the Buddhist teaching, they might have misunderstood that the Buddha, you know, didn't want people to really focus much on the body or to kind of preoccupy themselves with it. But so, you know, and that's why a lot of the Buddhist people, because their bodies are in bad shape, and even so many monks that I knew in Sri Lanka and other countries, they didn't do much exercise or so on, that they had difficulty meditating. When they meditate, their knees are up in the air, and naturally then they can't sit straight, so they, after 10 or 15 minutes, they give up because it's too painful, or they're just lost in their thoughts. And in the yoga centers, it's mostly, you know, concerned with the body culture. So, you know, I tried to bridge that and to, you know, bring them back and to balance that that connection of the body and knowing that, you know, the body affects the mind and the mind affects the body. And then not only in, let's say, in exercise and breathing, but other things we do with the body too, like the diet and so on. So the things we eat also affect the body and cause it either undue problems and so on. And, you know, because, you know, when you're sick and so on or have little energy, it's the last thing you want to do is meditate. When you're feeling more, you know, healthy and vibrant, then, you know, you want to meditate more. So this kind of, you know, in short, is that body-mind connection and what I, you know, always... You know, if there's a saying, you know, people are meditating more and enjoying it less. But people should meditate less and enjoy it more. Not really meditate less, but meditate more and enjoy it more. And this is one of the, you could be the missing link. Well, your meditation seems to stagnate because of perhaps, you know, poor posture and so on, and these other kind of aspects of the body that, you know, may, you know, be kind of neglected or in kind of poor shape. So basically that's what I wanted to share with you and encourage you that you, or it's not only yoga, but practices like Tai Chi and so on or other, are also very, you know, type of physical disciplines and mental disciplines that help to bring the mind and body back together.